A lot of your work focuses on the issue of poverty and disenfranchised groups and people who are just generally kind of marginalized. I wonder what attracted you to that issue in the first place.
Well, I like to think of my work, first of all, not as, I don't think of the communities that I'm working in as hopeless, poor communities. I'm really looking at how people get out of poverty. What are the social springboards that allow people to better their lives? Because in those poor communities, that's what they're thinking about. They're not thinking, oh, I'm living in a terrible place and my life is so miserable. They're like, how do I improve my daughter's chances to get an education? Why did I become interested in that? First of all, I would say never, ever trust anybody who has like a 25-word answer for why they do what they do. Motivations are complicated. My own mother had experienced acute poverty and had a real eye for inequality and social injustice. And in my own life, as a teenager, I got out of the blue incurable disease, lifelong disease, and I had advantages at the time, and since then I've had work that has health insurance, so I've had surgeries to make me a productive member of society when ordinarily if I hadn't had those, I wouldn't be working, I wouldn't be here on the radio. So I'm very much aware of how small advantages can change people's lives, and also how small disadvantages can keep people of extraordinary promise out of what we call the meritocratic competition.
Your book, Behind the Beautiful Forevers, it looks at the promise of meritocracy in the sort of 21st century globalized world that we live in. And it seems to sort of ask the question, to what extent is this a reality at all?
That's the essential question. I mean, particularly when you're here, for instance, here at Colorado College, very competitive place, many people who have achieved a certain purchase on the ladder, they tend to think, well, I earned it. I worked hard and I earned it. And one of the things that I'm trying to draw out in my book is how many people never even get to play in that competition. How many people are disqualified? In Anahuasi, it was simply not possible for a child born poor to get an education past the eighth grade. At the same time, the slum lanes of Anahuasi often, the residents often came from six or seven different places, speaking six or seven different languages. So there were kids in the slum lanes who spoke five or six languages. They were translating for their parents, and they might have been 7 or 8 years old. Those kids don't get a chance to compete. They won't get a chance to, without help, to finish high school. So for all of us who nominally succeed in the meritocracy, I think it's very important to have a sense of how flawed that meritocracy really is, and how much advantage we've had because of where we're born.
And for people who haven't read your book, can you just describe a little bit Anahuasi, what this place is?
Yeah. If any listeners have been to the Mumbai airport, you would fly to the international airport, and you'd be driving through the center city down a road where at the time I started reporting, all you would see was a wall advertising Italian floor tiles, and it said, "Beautiful forever, beautiful forever, beautiful forever." But behind the wall was a settlement, a slum made of houses made of tin and cardboard and plastic and a few of brick, where thousands of people were waking up every day and trying to figure out where what they could do with minimal skills and what the markets need might intersect. They were really trying to invent a future for themselves. And Anahuasi was one of 30 settlements at the international airport, slum settlements, and half the people in Mumbai, close to half, live in slums. But the important thing to know about that is that by the way the Indian government counts poverty, almost nobody in Mumbai slums are considered poor anymore. They're part of the success story of modern global capitalism in India, which was for the last decade the second fastest growing economy in the world behind China.
On the issue of the success story of global capitalism, I think there's something interesting about the phrase trickle-down economics. Your book kind of, in a way, sort of documents what really is trickling down from the successes that some people are experiencing in India. And in a lot of ways, it's these scavengers literally picking through the trash that has trickled down
Right.
from this wealthy society or other kinds of values that are trickling down. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Right. I mean, I was so fascinated when I first started working in the slum to see the connection between the garbage industry and the global market. So the things that so many people in the slums were living on buying and reselling wine bottles, newspapers, electronics, cassette tapes, things that richer people had thrown away. And in traditional literature about the slums, this would be considered very abject work. But in fact, the people of the slum were making a living better than they ever had before. And one of the things that's important to emphasize is that for the people in the slum, and for many people that I've spent time with in other slums across India, they're not nostalgic for a time before the economic liberalization of 1991. They see more hope in the 21st century society, but they're also negotiating a world that is incredibly corrupt because other people in this society also have hope to get ahead. And so there's so much competition, and there's a great deal of preying on people who have less power. And so they're trying to better their lives in incredibly difficult circumstances. Still, for now, they believe that it is possible to break the barrier between the slum world and the middle class world. What one has to wonder after years and years of difficulty and struggle is how longer that hope can be sustained. And Indian elections are coming up soon, and I think we're at a real crossroads.
What message would you have for people who read your book and come away feeling like, wow, things in India are terrible? You know, like that's really, it would really be terrible to be a poor person in India, and don't make any kinds of larger connections to maybe the global financial system or global markets or American society. How could you kind of bridge that gap for those readers?
That's a great question. And one of the things that I've learned since the book came out is that you can't control how people read what you do. And there are people who are going to look at a book like that and say, oh, that represents India. Okay, that one slum can stand in for 1.2 billion people. You know, you're talking about one of the most diverse countries on earth. But like I said, you know, sometimes you just have to say, I've done my best to bring not just the colossal unfairness, but also to convey to readers the intellectual possibilities of the people in the community. And this spectacular injustice of a world when so much of the government and charity assistance that's supposed to be changing their lives isn't getting to them. And I think, I hope that some people will come away from reading the book thinking, not this is bad, but we must do better for these people. And so how do we begin today to start making things a little more fair for people, not just in Anawadi, but all over the world who are excluded from what we comfort ourselves as calling the meritocracy.
It's a beautiful book and incredibly powerful. And thank you so much for taking the time to come and speak with me.
Thanks for these great questions.